Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us for this episode of the Wicked Solutions series on thefutureeconomy.ca. I'm Nick Betts, Managing Director of Kanza. Today's conversation tackles a question that's become more urgent every day. Can we afford sustainable food? We'll explore how Canada's food and beverage manufacturing sector can improve productivity, reduce its environmental footprint, and still deliver food that is both affordable and aligned with evolving consumer expectations. Importantly, we're talking about what innovations, partnerships, and systems-level thinking are required to get us there. To elaborate more on this topic, I'll hand it over to our co-host, David Hughes, President and CEO of Generate Canada.
Thanks, Nick. As part of this Wicked Solution series by Generate Canada, we're diving into challenges that are deeply complex, where social, environmental, and economic factors are all interconnected. Food affordability and sustainability is a classic wicked problem. It's not just about farming practices or carbon emissions. It's also about supply chains and equity and land use and public health and even cultural identity. As climate pressures grow and consumer demands shift, Canada has an opportunity to lead by developing a more resilient, responsive food system. But to do that, we need to rethink how we define productivity in the first place. Not just in terms of volume and efficiency, but in terms of nutrition, accessibility, and long-term sustainability. I'm very excited about this discussion. So, Nick, back to you.
Today's discussion brings together expert voices who are working on exactly that. Dana McCauley, CEO of the Canadian Food Innovation Network, brings deep insight into the technologies and collaborations shaping the future of food. And Marie-Claude Bourgie, Vice President of Sustainability at Farm Credit Canada, brings a unique perspective on how financing and sustainability can work hand in hand across the value chain. Let's get into it. What does productivity mean in today's food system, and how should we be redefining it for a future that demands both sustainability and affordability?
It's interesting because traditionally productivity has been measured by, output per worker in context of, GDP created by a per capita number. And as we move into an age of automation and we need potentially fewer hands, still lots of heads, but fewer hands working in food processing and food manufacturing, or maybe even in food service establishments where the tasks that have normally been done by a person might be more automated or scheduled differently. But we do have to recalibrate how we think about productivity. A very common metric when someone like me writes a grant application and wins it for their organization is how many jobs you created. Well, in some cases, we might be displacing low-quality jobs in the future and replacing them with much more cerebral and intellectually focused jobs that pay a lot more. So really understanding the quality of the work, I think, is a big part of the future productivity equation.
So for us, the way we see productivity, it's efficiency and effectiveness. People mix production and productivity. You can still increase your production, but not increase your productivity, which is quite interesting. But for us, we see it like similar to what Dana, you're saying, like the labor efficiency, the input, the resource utilization, yield per hectares. There's a series of metrics we could look at to see if the productivity is increasing in terms of labor, capital, material use. The idea is to produce more with less. So essentially, if it boils down to, if you look at the aggregated measure, is are we producing more with less? And for us, the question is pertinent. Should we redefine it in terms of sustainability and affordability? For us, it's sort of a vector to achieve sustainability and affordability. As a nation, are we really investing at the right place so we can improve our yield, like use less resource to produce more? And hopefully this will lead to more food, more production, more affordability. And by using less inputs, indirectly, it leads to sustainability as well. So we see it more as a vector rather than redefining it.
That's interesting because more consumers, it seems like many consumers, more and more are perceiving sustainable food as more expensive. How do we tackle that narrative and what are the real economic drivers behind food costs today?
Yeah, I'd love to jump in on that. It's really interesting how we've had to approach sustainability, and in this definition of sustainability, food that's better for the planet, I think is what you're trying to get at, Nick. And think about, you know, in this transitionary time to having a more sustainable food system, that it will be more expensive, right? Because we're figuring it out. There's testing and learning, and there's optimization happening. But, you know, when companies adopt technologies that help them to, for instance, turn waste into valuable side stream products, new revenue streams, really intuitively, the prices for those sustainable foods should actually go down. And it's my thesis that by helping existing Canadian food businesses and beverage businesses to adopt technology to do exactly what Marie Claude just said, that they will find these efficiencies and they will find these new revenue streams and eliminate the cost. Because a waste stream, if you're a company, you know, you don't just put it out on the curb, but you have to pay a company to come and take that waste away. So there's a, you know, a double benefit for turning that into a revenue stream. So as we transition the food manufacturing and food processing industries towards using technologies and adopting new methods, we should at the very least see a stabilization of prices. We may not be able to reduce prices because the economy is very dynamic and there's a lot of different forces going on that, you know, put pressure on things like the dollar and interest rates and all that kind of thing. But adopting technology should help ambitious companies that are, you know, run well to have more margin and be able to offer their customers, grocers, better prices or fewer price increases at the very least.
Yeah, I completely agree that the technology innovation will help curb the price rise in food. And we all go to the grocery store and we're all shocked when we get to the cash register, especially since the COVID. So if we look at the real economy, what are the drivers at this cost? And to Dana's point, how can technology solve these drivers? There's supply chain disruption that was a huge driver of food inflation, whether it's pandemic, the threat of tariffs, and so on and so forth. Can't ignore floods, droughts, and so on in the value chain. Rising costs of inputs. We talked about productivity. Labor is more expensive. Fuel's more expensive. Inputs more expensive. Global events, the geopolitical, and even currency fluctuations, right? So all these things have a huge effect on inflation, because when you look at the product, there's before the farm, there's on the farming, but there's after the farm and the transformation. So at all these steps, inflation adds on. According to our chief economist, the two biggest drivers are food supply disruption, so the supply chain disruption, and the weather condition. And if you break it down, that accounts for 50% of the food inflation, right? So to Dana's point, I think that innovation and technology could help build more resilient supply chain in our countries. So if we increase our productivity and drive a solid, robust supply chain, and also use technology to add resiliency to our food chain, resiliency to weather events, just that we can affect 50% of what we've seen in recent food inflation. So I think those are the drivers we should work on. And the irony is, as a nation, can we afford not to have sustainable food? Because what's not included in the food price is externalities, the effect on health and on the environment. Society will pay for it, our communities will pay for it, but consumers don't pay it at the cash register. So by having stronger communities through the value chain and at being more resilient on climate, we're also having an effect on the externalities that are not reflected in the price.
Can I jump in here? You've both referenced technology, and we all recognize the importance of technology as we move forward. But for our listeners, can you help us understand a little bit what that technology really is? Because it comes in all shapes and forms. But I think to give people a sense of what we really need to invest in and what's going to be needed, to have a sense of what technologies we're talking about would be very helpful.
It's such a difficult question to answer succinctly. I have been working now at CFIN for 4 years, and I've been trying to come up with a 3 to 5 word definition to your question. But you're right, it's very broad. It's everything from robotics and automation to cutting edge future focused technologies like cultivated meat and other cellular types of foods. Between those two gateposts, you have things like food safety systems that are driven by machine learning. You have biotech engineered functional foods. So for instance, ingredients, I mentioned waste streams a few minutes ago. So ingredients that would be made from something like, say, the waste in winemaking, you can remove the polyphenols and then use precision fermentation to create a clean label ingredient that will reduce the amount of sugar or salt you need to put into chocolate, for instance. That opens up a new consumer market. It also reduces the cost for the manufacturer. So we have, you know, all kinds of really smart people. This is where Canada has an incredible, incredible asset. We have a fantastic post-secondary system that turns out, you know, the very smart, highly qualified personnel who can build these technologies, identify solutions of all kinds for many, many different stakeholders and bring them to market, because we have this amazing startup ecosystem that supports them in that entrepreneurial journey where they get to proof of concept. So really almost any problem that you can think of in the food system, there is a technology and science IP-based solution that someone is working on.
Yeah, those seem like really meaningful shifts around that cost sustainability balance that are necessary and we can build upon.
And it's growing like crazy. Sorry to cut you off, Nick, but our recent report, the Food Tech in Canada report, we identified that along that agri-food tech continuum that we have 75% of the companies in that space are working on the food tech solutions. Agritech is more established in Canada, gets a lot more attention from trade commission efforts and investors and that kind of thing. But we're at a bit of a flashpoint for food technology, and it's an amazing new opportunity for Canada to create a new export revenue stream.
Across the value chain, the technology innovation is quite impressive from the before the farm, the inputs, the seed technology to increase the yield, and also precision agriculture. We're seeing unbelievable results with really being able to apply just the right amount of inputs at the right time, given conditions. And the use of AI now in all the farm machineries has really increased the ability to use inputs with more precision. And then you go in the transformation, what Vino was talking about, like, how do you use waste, whether it's the energy, whether it's the biomass, the products? So do you transform that into protein for feed? Do you put that in the transform product? So we do have a lot of clients in our portfolio that use circular economy, reducing costs, improving the bottom line, and also really reducing waste. So it's quite impressive. I think for Canada, it's unbelievable breeding ground. If we leverage our competitive advantage, we have the land base, we have really sophisticated labor, we have access to capital, we have the weather conditions. And I know trading with the US right now is a bit of a contentious issue, but if you look at how much they're investing in R&D, just by the sheer size of their economy, according to my statistics, it's about 23 times more than what Canada is able to invest in R&D. So what we're also looking at, let's look at what works in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, and leapfrog a bit the curve to using these technology by importing this technology and really leveraging our competitive advantage, which is the labor and the landmass.
What's really interesting, though, is like when we look at Series A type funding across Canada, the US, the UK, we're on par. So like I mentioned, we have an amazing startup ecosystem in Canada, but where we fall behind and the opportunity is to help these companies to scale. We get companies to proof of concept, get them to, if you're into TRLs, into like TRL 7, and then we say, oh, come back to us once you are ready to, you know, be a global company with 10,000 employees. We really have to shift our investment culture. We need to think about how to create accelerators that are focused or have capacity to accommodate the special needs of food tech. If you look at the four pillars that our global affairs function in Canada looks at, they have ICT, agriculture, biomedical, and one other that's slipping my mind right now. Food tech and agritech fit into all four of those. So there's never actually just an effort for these particular types of companies. So they're not getting connected like Lego into the right spaces. There's always a bit of round peg square hole going on. So we really need a vision for growing the food sector. Right now, the part of the food value chain that my group, Canadian Food Innovation Network, represents is $102 billion in GDP. That's a lot of money. It can grow. We just need to break down the specific things we need to do and quit speaking in generalities.
And I'm curious what roles the different parts of the agri-food sector have in doing that, in de-risking innovation, in driving forward different opportunities for collaboration, different investment potential. What roles do government, finance sector, industry itself, farmers play in this, specifically looking at potentially those underfunded groups, whether they're small or medium-sized producers and processors?
Yes, so FCC does have a new strategy, and sustainability is at the core of the strategy with the lens of increasing productivity and really lift the ag sector in Canada. So we do have a strategy at FCC to take on more risk, to really be coherent in our approach to wanting to increase sustainability and productivity. So there's a few ways we can do that. So one of the, it's to diversify our tool of economical instrument. We started an equity line. So we're able to now invest in equity in companies, which allows us to go in certain markets where we weren't and really pick and choose the technologies that we believe would be beneficial to really grow the industry and add value to the whole value chain. So that's an instrument that's enabled us to take more risk and be consequential. We also open our risk appetite statement to really be able to, you know, we used to do only senior debt. Now we're like, how can we expand that and look at companies that are pushing the envelope in terms of ag tech and energy and different practices? And are we willing to take more risk if we can justify the impacts and if these impacts can be translated and have a ripple effect across the value chain? So these are the type of things where we're taking on more risk. And also we understand that producers only have one chance a year to have it right. So we have a very strong data strategy using our platform Ag Experts. How do we consolidate data? And also our network of innovative farm, the smart farms that we call it. And to your point, Dana, like, we bring in technology, but can we test it in our geography with our practices on our landscapes at scale? So we do have a network of farms that we use to test these technologies. And it's our role to produce data and insights and knowledge. We also look at best practices across our client base in other nations to gather the information because, and it was mentioned a bit earlier, if you look at our portfolio, 80% are small business enterprises. They have 6-7 balls in the air. They don't have time to really focus on this. And we take it as our role to consolidate the data, consolidate the information, and present to them that from our experience, a producer will need 3 years of data to even contemplate changing a practice. And it's quite understandable. So we want to be that aggregator and develop the evidence base. So that's one way.
Yeah, down at our capital F section of the value chain, there's a culture shift that needs to change as well. If you think about last time you went to farmers market or the grocery store, handmade, artisan, old fashioned, those words, we put a lot of value into that type of language that, you know, makes food feel like it came from a person. And that's, in some ways, there's this tension among those SMEs because Margot is correct. Canada is, you know, we don't have the huge mega brands generally dominating the grocery store shelves in Canada. We have a lot of small and medium-sized enterprises that have less than 10 employees, less than 50 employees, where you are doing things often without a lot of automation because you started out doing it in a very culinary way. So one of the things that I think is very important and that CFIN is advocating for is the creation of opportunities to have those SMEs interact with technologies, maybe at, you know, research and development centers where they can try technology and see how it works without having to take their line off or without having to reskill their employees so that they can develop confidence that this will help their business and that it won't impact the quality of the food that they put out. And to that point, all of the funding that CFIN distributes is about getting proof of concept. So we only fund projects that have an innovator and a test bed, generally an anchor firm or a medium-sized company who say, yeah, we're going to put in, you know, 50% of the funding to test this, to try it, to solve this problem. And so we tell a lot of stories, if we get the opportunity to get people's ears, to show them that, yes, this can work. Because definitely that cohort of businesses who have tons of growth potential, they're stalled at rolling spring rolls by hand. And so I want to help them to, you know, do that in new ways.
You both referenced the increased investment that's going to be required and also the need to increase our risk tolerance. And I'm wondering, where do you believe new investment is going to come from? And how do we share that risk across this broader ecosystem so that the burden isn't all on one element of the supply chain?
I think we need to make the ag sector sexy again. Like, the potential is there. We're a financial institution solely dedicated to the ag industry. So for us, it's our only focus. But if you look at other financial institutions, normally in their portfolio, ag and food transformation is just a small. So we really need to tell the Canadian story and demonstrate the role, like how big the industry can be, and make it sexy again. If you look at it, to meet zero hunger and lower emission, the world will need 14% more food. So there's tremendous opportunity. And according to statistics, like, if Canada, we invest in productivity over the next 10 years, that's a $30 billion opportunity, right? So if we're able to articulate that, the idea is to crowd in also money from the unusual suspect or the private sector or foreign investment in Canada, I believe. So, and who's going to take the risk? We do believe that the role of a crown corporation is to take the risk. And there's different financial instruments we could do that, because we do have the double mandate to really elevate the industry in its entire value chain, as well as provide a dividend to our shareholder. But we do want to lean on that other side and be a vector and a catalyst to bring in other capital in the sector.
For the food tech companies, because it's so nascent and because it's growing so quickly, education is a huge, huge element. So, for instance, our Food Tech in Canada ecosystem report was very, very warmly received because it had new information. It quantified how many companies there are and what they're doing and, you know, where they're getting investment, where they're not. VCs were very receptive to that information. And then also food tech companies were very receptive because now they have some facts to put into their pitch decks to educate investors. So a big part of CFIN's mandate for the near future is to continue to bring, you know, some visibility to what is hiding there right under our noses, and to help the finance functions in Canada and beyond to understand that. It's also something I'm working on. Partnerships was mentioned at the beginning of our webinar, but we haven't talked a lot about it, but I'm exploring how we develop the relationships with accelerator programs and institutions who specialize in scaling, so that when I and my team, when we identify that a company is ready for that, how do we connect them into the right type of organization at the right time? So I think there is, you know, some stewardship, which I'm happy to take on, and a lot of education, because as I mentioned, food tech can help us to be more competitive here at home, but it also can be this extremely valuable export opportunity for Canada, creating basically a whole new revenue stream.
And to do that, Dana, I guess there's, you know, we have an evolving global marketplace with different types of trade than we've seen in the recent past. We're seeing an explosive domestic market that's changing, and competitiveness trends are changing. What is the most crucial opportunity that we need to unlock to take advantage, or to act, maybe just live in the space that we're in?
I love the wording you used, you know, the opportunity we can unlock, because Canada has more trade agreements with more countries than any other G7 country. We have chosen, for a whole bunch of reasons, which we don't have to go into right now, to focus a lot of our energy on a, you know, north-south relationship, trade relationship, but we're in really good shape to just start doing things a little bit differently. And I'm finding that international partners are very, very interested. I get a lot of inbound requests. I've recently created an MOU with a group out of Japan, one with New Zealand Food Innovation Network. EIT Food, the European Innovation and Technology Group, is exploring how to work more with Canada. So we have a lot of warm leads. So I think, again, you know, examining how the value map works, what do we want, what do they want, how it maps, and then making the right connections and leveraging this existing very luxurious number of agreements that we have is the immediate first step.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That would completely unlock our potential. I'm hoping that we're going to see in the near future is a heavy investment in infrastructure. What the tariffs threat has demonstrated is our infrastructures in Canada are depleting. And yeah, we do all have these trade agreements, but if you go in the middle of the prairies, you're very far from a port, you know what I mean? And even to trade between the provinces, I think our transport infrastructures need to be, you know, we need to put heavy investment in that. Also energy, renewable energy, there's a huge potential for greenhouses and different types of transformation if we invest in various types of energy. And also the infrastructure, digital access. We talked about precision ag, but the producers need access to 5G to really put it forward. Statistics show that there's $2 to $3 billion productivity that's sitting there just if we give access to very good digital access to remote areas. I didn't even mention irrigation. You know, if there's potential to transform entire regions, economies, and communities with irrigation infrastructure. So that would definitely give a big boost to the industry.
You can extend what Marie-Claude said into manufacturing as well. There's a dearth of opportunity for companies to engage in toll manufacturing and larger scale, you know, like tens of thousands of cases type of production before having to invest in their own facility. And we can do a lot to help companies to scale more quickly and respond to large orders while keeping their costs very low so that then they have money to invest in the future.
I just want to pull a little bit on this thread around data. My uncle had a farm and the data was really when the local farmers all gathered in the barn and they talked about what was happening and what they were choosing as their different feed and different things. Today, and recently we were on a farm where there were terminals with all kinds of data on the screen. I think you spoke earlier about that precision decision-making about what they're doing with their crops and the level of data that was being used, you know, was very exciting. And you could see how that could be transformative. But my guess is that this is very differentiated across the country in terms of what data is being tracked, who's tracking it, what information is being shared, and where it's being held in some kind of aggregated way. And there's a lot of things that will get in the way of us being able to change that, is my guess. But it's a critical enabler to the change that we're looking for. What can either of you share with regards to what we can do to move towards a more ubiquitous, harmonized, and centrally kind of available data set that will enable us to make the change that we've been talking about?
The problem with sharing data is, of course, people are always worried about giving away trade secrets and proprietary information. The other issue is, going back to one of my favorite Lego analogies, is that the data, once it's put into a data lake, it doesn't always match. So it's interesting. I was reading something about the medical world and, you know, it's clunky and a lot of people criticize it, but they have some very specific codes that they use to make sure that something as simple as billing in the medical world is consistent from medical practice to medical practice, hospital to hospital, so that everybody kind of knows what this number means. And there's probably a role for some kind of effort that helps people to use at least in part, you know, maybe 25 or 50% of the data that everyone would be capturing to do it in a very similar fashion. I am not a data scientist. I'm trained as a chef and I have a degree in English literature. So I don't know how you do it, but it feels like the way to facilitate sharing because it's very difficult right now.
I'm not a data scientist either, but for FCC, this is really a pillar that we really want to lean on. And we do have a proprietary platform, a digital platform that 25,000 producers are using. I think we cover about 6 million acres in Canada. So we're starting to get a critical mass with this data. So of course, producers, as you mentioned, and entrepreneurs are protective of their data. That's their secret sauce. So we don't use the data. It's not tied to consumer, but we can use it aggregated. So we use the aggregated data. And so the platform is used to manage the farm. And there's also an accounting module. So if you put the accounting and the management, the two of them together, you can really have amazing set of data to demonstrate what works and what doesn't for different producers, again, at the aggregated level. And what we're seeing right now is a producer in Nova Scotia doesn't know what a producer in BC does. They don't talk to each other. But if we're able to put these together, and now this is me repeating what I heard, but there's technology called digital twins, so that you sort of recreate digitally your working condition on your farm, and you can test virtually new methods to see if it's going to work using statistic and climate models and all this. So the technology is getting very sophisticated, and this is something that we're really leaning on. Again, as a Crown Corporation, we're not using this to sell the data at all. It's really to consolidate the data and produce material that can be used for the industry. Very exciting. It's great.
It's super exciting. I mean, being in the egg industry for a couple of decades now and seeing the development and the growth and the acceleration of what technology looks like and what it means to be a farmer and what it means to be a food processor has changed so dramatically over the last while. Well, it's probably always has, right? Just at a rate of speed now. We're coming to the end of our session now, unfortunately, but I'd like each of you to provide an answer for this question, bringing it back up to that 10,000 foot level. But what must Canada do to be a leader on this topic?
I mentioned it before. What I would love to see Canada do is that I think the Canadian government must invest in the infrastructure. We need to really set our industry with the infrastructure, energy, irrigation, transport, digital access, and that would really bring us to the level of productivity.
Yeah. I would say there are two big opportunities. The first one is to help existing businesses who are in, you know, the food sector to grow and to find margin and be more productive. And one of the ways they can do that is by being aware of and adopting technologies that can, you know, make them much, much more efficient with their inputs and outputs. The second is to recognize that we have this burgeoning subsector in food tech and really figure out what those food tech companies need so that they can scale, because they are solving global problems. They're starting to do it here in Canada, but they have a tremendous opportunity to have impact that will have a food system bottom line, a GDP result for Canada, and a food security bottom line as well for everybody in the world, not just for Canada.
Thank you both for such an insightful discussion. It's clear that building a more sustainable and affordable food system will require a whole sector approach. Industry, innovation, policy, consumers all have a role to play. So what stood out to me today is just how much potential there is in where we are. And if we focus and collaborate and redefine what success looks like together, that will take us beyond our short-term outcomes and into more long-term sustainability. David?
Yeah, I would first of all say this was a fantastic conversation, and there's so much more that we need to discuss and we want to discuss. But a few things: this message that sustainability and sustainable farming, regenerative farming, does not necessarily have to mean more cost, or cost to the consumer. In fact, there are opportunities here, if we seize them, that can do quite the opposite. The second is to not just think of sustainability in terms of environmental sustainability. There's economic sustainability for the farmers, for the communities that serve those farmers, and increased stabilization in the kind of economic structure within our farming system in Canada that can also come as we start to think of sustainability in different terms. The other is that this is clearly a wicked challenge in a complex ecosystem that has so many different dimensions to it that really makes it worthy of a kind of Wicked Solutions series kind of conversation. This really is at the heart of the kinds of challenges we're trying to overcome. But I'm struck by the issue and concern around scale, because we've talked about it here, but it shows up in industries all across Canada, where we are so good at the front end of the curve and so bad at scale and leveraging the true economic benefits that come from new technologies, new innovation. So how do we overcome that? Well, I heard a few things. One is that we have to be better at our education in informing people across the entire value chain and ecosystem. And that may mean also making it a little bit sexy. We need data. We need to really harness new technologies at a different scale. That's going to require new investment and thoughtful investment and sourcing in new types of investment and eliminating some of the risk that's involved or having a higher risk tolerance and infrastructure that's going to be required to all of this. And lastly, I would say that in order to drive the systems change we're looking for, we really need a national vision and agenda, and we need to have a way to bring together and collaborate across a much larger spectrum of actors in this ecosystem. But I can't thank you enough for your contributions to this conversation and to our ongoing work to try and tackle some of these wicked problems. Nick?
Thanks, David. And thanks again, Dana, Marie-Claude, and to everybody who joined us for this conversation today. Remember to subscribe to the futureeconomy.ca's newsletter for more episodes, and check out generatecanada.ca for more Wicked Solutions.